Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on American defense and intelligence strategy in the 21st century. I'll be in conversation with Leon Panetta. He's the former Secretary of Defense and former director of the CIA. This event was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience at the Marines Memorial Association. And now to our conversation.
So we're going to try not to talk about the good old days, but I did want to take you to your most recent service in the Obama administration, both at the CIA, heading up the CIA, and as Secretary of Defense. Secretary Shultz referenced Abbottabad, referenced the raid that that brought about the death of bin Laden. Talk a little bit about the planning and the decision-making that led to that moment.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And I want to thank everyone in the audience. I want to thank those in the audience for the service you provided this country. Our democracy would not be what it is without people that are willing to serve this country. And I thank you for that. And I also want to thank George Shultz. He is... you know, he's one of those very dedicated Americans who really cares about this country. And I think history will look back at George Shultz and say he was one of the great Americans to serve in a number of capacities to try to help America remain strong. So I pay tribute to George Shultz for me. So when I go back to this job as CIA director, and I wasn't quite sure when the president called me, I thought maybe he intended to call Norm Mineta rather than Leon Panetta, because I'd been doing, you know, I'd worked on budget stuff and what have you. And he said, no, I want you to come back as CIA director. And of course, since we were involved in the war on terrorism, it was something that I felt would be a challenge and wanted to do it. Well, when I first came back, you know, it was clear that the message I got from the president and others was we have not been able to locate bin Laden. We don't know where he is. Your job is to go after him. And so I went back to the CIA and sat down with the people there, and I basically said, look, what's been going on? And the reality was that everybody had been involved, and that means nobody is in charge, as all of you know. And I said, look, I've got to have somebody in charge of the search for bin Laden. So I appointed one individual to be in charge of the team going after him. And I said, you're going to report to me every week on what you're doing. And when you come in here, I expect you not to tell me there's no progress. I expect you to come in and give me a number of ideas about what you're looking at, what you're trying in order to see if you can find bin Laden. And so we went through a number of weeks of that, and you know, they were looking at several different options to try to see what might lead to where bin Laden was located. Every path they followed led nowhere for a number of years. They just could not, you know, they didn't know whether he was living in caves or living somewhere in the Middle East or living in Pakistan. They just didn't know. So we finally decided they focused on the issue of the couriers, because bin Laden operated through couriers. They're the ones that delivered his message. And thankfully, as they pieced together intelligence, various pieces of intelligence that came in, they had not been able to identify these couriers, but they were able, as a result of intelligence, to be able to determine the names of these couriers, and then they attached a face to these couriers. And we were able to locate them in a town called Peshawar in Pakistan. And we did surveillance, followed them. They got into a white SUV and went from Peshawar south to this place called Abbottabad. When they went to this compound in Abbottabad, and we took a look at the compound, we knew something was up, because this compound was about 3 times larger than most of the compounds in the area. It had 18-foot walls on one side, 12-foot walls on another side, had a 8-foot wall on the third floor. You know, normally you like to look at the view from the third floor, but they had a wall on the third floor. We looked at the clothes and the clothesline and determined that the number of family members living there matched the number of family members in the bin Laden family. The one thing we also found out was that they did not make any phone calls from the compound. They would go 90 miles away in order to make a phone call. High security, high walls, barbed wire, the whole bit. We said, we obviously have something going on here. And we put it under surveillance immediately and continue to do surveillance. At one point, we noticed that there was somebody who would go out into a yard and walk around like a prisoner in a prison yard. He would come out, walk around a number of times, and then go back in. So I told the people at the CIA, I said, for God's sakes, let's try to get an ID on this guy. You know, I don't care. Put a telescope on a mountain, put, cameras on the wall, do something. We need to get an ID because it could be bin Laden. They said, the walls are there. We can't get a good angle on this. I said, look, I've seen movies where the CIA can do this. They weren't able to do it. I said, well, at least tell me how tall he is. Because, bin Laden was 6'4". Tell me from the shadows, you can obviously give me an estimate. And they finally came back and said that he's somewhere between 5'8 and 6'5". So that didn't do much good either. We continued to do surveillance. We continued to gather intelligence. And we put, bits and pieces together. And in my mind, it did indicate that there was a good chance bin Laden was there. But we never had 100% identity. And so eventually, because we were concerned that it was going to leak at some point that, that we were looking at this compound in Abbottabad, we determined that we had to figure out what kind of operation we would do to go after the compound. And we looked at 3 options at the time. I sat down with Bill McCraven and basically said, Bill, give me some options here for an operation. Well, the first one was just to blow the hell out of the place with a B-2 bomber, which is not a bad idea. It was just, it was kind of clean and, you get rid of the guy that way. But the problem was the amount of ordnance they would need to blow this place up would level several villages around the area. So we decided not to do that. There was also talk about using a drone. But the problem with the drone is that we would not know whether it was bin Laden, and also the drone's fires, the Hellfire, sometimes they hit and sometimes they don't. So we settled on a commando raid using the SEALs, and Bill McCraven said the SEALs ought to do this. We then went to the NSC, the National Security Council, and sat around. And I have to tell you, a majority of the people in the NSC thought it was too risky. And I can't blame them. It was risky. They were concerned that we didn't have solid information that it was bin Laden. And thought it was risky going into Pakistan. By the way, the decision was made not to work with the Pakistanis because we had given intelligence to the Pakistanis about where some terrorists were located, and ultimately those terrorists would disappear because somebody was telling them what the hell was going on. So we thought we couldn't trust the Pakistanis. So President asked me what I thought, and I said, look, Mr. President, I've had an old formula I used when I was in Congress, which was when I face a tough decision, ask an ordinary citizen in my district, if you knew what I knew, what would you do? And I said, if I told the average citizen in my district that we had the best intelligence on the location of bin Laden since Tora Bora, I think that citizen would say, you have to do it. And Mr. President, I think you have to do it. To his credit, he made that decision the next morning. We had the SEALs already located in Afghanistan. 2 helicopters, at night, 150 miles into Pakistan. It was obviously a risky operation. We didn't know what they'd run into when they got to the compound. As a matter of fact, one of the helicopters, as we were following the operation, one of the helicopters, because it was a hot day, the heat from the ground came up and stalled one of the engines on the helicopter. Thank God there was a great pilot who settled that helicopter down. At the time, I was in touch with Bill McCraven. I said, Bill, what the hell's going on? Bill didn't miss a beat. He said, don't worry. The mission's going on. They're going to continue this. We've got another helicopter coming in that'll help get them out. And they did that. They breached walls, went in. We heard fire, knew that something was up. There was about 15 minutes. And then we finally got the code word Geronimo, that it was bin Laden. And they were able to get on the helicopter and get the hell out and come back. I can't tell you how proud I am of the SEALs and the way they conducted that operation and were able to get it done. And I thought it sent a very clear message to the world that the United States, anybody who attacks the United States of America is not going to get away with it. And I thought that was an important message to send the world.
So at the time, both Vice President Biden, who'd chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Secretary Gates, the Secretary of Defense, recommended against taking action. What did that experience tell you about President Obama's comfort with risk?
Well, you know, obviously when he made the decision to do it, because I was nervous about it as director of the CIA, because there were so many at the NSC who were nervous about the operation. And look, Bob Gates had been through the operation in the Carter administration.
That's
when
right.
They tried to go after our our hostages in Tehran at the time.
And that was a case where there was a helicopter accident.
And so, it did, yeah. And it basically stopped the operation from going forward. So he was nervous about that. Others were nervous about other aspects of it. When the president told Tom Donilon, who was the head of the NSC, and Tom called me and said, the president's made the decision to go. And I said, Tom, I'm glad he made that decision. Tom said, look, I think the president really feels that, it is important. We've got intelligence that it might be him, and that we're not just going to walk away from this. And I thought it was very important. Look, presidents of the United States, leaders have to take risky decisions. That's the nature of leadership, is to take risky decisions. And he was willing to do that. And obviously, it could have, it could have blown up. We could have had, a terrible operation in which we, got into a shooting war with Pakistanis. But that did not happen. It was successful, and I think it's a very important message to send people who get involved in leadership positions that if you're going to be a leader, you're going to have to take risks.
Yep.
Commanders in the military understand what risks are all about, and you take risks. You're not stupid about it, but you take risks because in the end, that's the way you get things done.
Yeah. You mentioned drones and the hellfires. We tend to, when we read about drones in the news, it tends to be about strikes. But could you talk a little bit about what this capability has meant in the war on terror, but in the following ways, the degree to which it's providing a sort of situational awareness on the battlefield, the ways in which it's used to extend the capabilities of our men and women and protect their lives as well.
Look, drones are a weapon system. It's a weapon system for the future, and they're going to increase. People around the world now are investing in drones. And drones have tremendous capability, not only for surveillance, but obviously for the kind of operations that were necessary. And the reality is that, look, in dealing with Pakistan, because the leaders of Al-Qaeda left Afghanistan and went into the tribal areas of Pakistan. They were our enemy. They're the ones who were involved in 9/11. We declared war on these, on Al-Qaeda. Well, going after them became the problem of having to deal with Pakistan. So, you know, normally we would send F-16s in to blow the hell out of them. Well, the Pakistanis said, no, you can't use our airspace for your fighters. We would also send ground troops in, boots on the ground, to go after them. And the Pakistanis said, no, you can't use boots on the ground. And yet we are confronting this enemy who is continuing to plan additional 9/11 attacks. And so ultimately, you know, it happened in the Bush administration when the president said that, you know, we needed to use this capability to try to go after this enemy. They tried to do it initially with the Pakistanis and wanted their permission. But the Pakistanis just would delay giving them an answer. And, you know, when you spot a target, you got to move. So ultimately, the president, to his credit, made the decision we aren't going to wait for the Pakistanis. When I became CIA director, I didn't realize I was going to become a combatant commander, but that was my job. And I have to tell you that the ability to go after these individuals and do it using that capability provides a very precise and well-targeted weapon that goes after, you know, a specific target. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was the individual. When I get the you get the information, and you got to decide whether you pull the trigger or not. And these are not easy decisions. But the reality is, if you're going to do this kind of operation, it's true in Yemen and elsewhere, by the way, you need good intelligence on the ground. You got to have the ability to know what's happening on the ground, to identify those targets, and be able to have credible intelligence. And once you get credible intelligence, and once you implement surveillance, then you get a pretty good idea of where that target is. And I have to tell you, because of that capability, we literally decimated Al-Qaeda's leadership in the tribal areas. It was a very effective weapon. We're using it, obviously, in Yemen. I'm sure we're using it in Syria and elsewhere, because not only does it provide, as I said, the capability to do surveillance, to be able to determine what those targets are, but once you determine that target, you have the capability to strike. And that, you know, that is a very effective weapon when you're in war.
To hear the presidential candidates speak, we're in an election year and a primary season, is a constant reference to restoring the military. Has our military been degraded? And are there decisions you took as OMB director or as Secretary of Defense, cuts you made that you later regretted?
Well, look, when you're dealing with budgets, and I've dealt with budgets as chairman of the Budget Committee and as director of OMB, obviously as director of the CIA and as Secretary of Defense. When I went in as Secretary of Defense, I was handed a number to reduce the defense budget by almost $487 billion, almost a half a trillion dollars. The Congress, in their budget act that they passed, required that we reduce the budget by that amount. At the time, I said, "Look, I'm not just going to slash $487 billion out of the budget. What I wanted to do it was to use that as an opportunity to sit down and talk about what is the defense strategy we want for the future? What do we want the Defense Department to look like?" And so we sat down, and I sat down with the military, and I sat down with our civilians at the Defense Department, and we developed a strategy for the 21st century that basically said, you know, number one, we are going to be leaner, but we have to be agile, and we've got to develop good technology. Two, we've got to be able to make sure that we can project forces into the Pacific and into the Middle East. And so projecting those forces was important. Number three, we wanted to also make sure that we could fight two wars at one time if we had to. and had that capability. If we went to war in Korea and somebody closed the Straits of Hormuz, we had to have the ability to go after both. Fourthly, we had to have a presence in the rest of the world. And they came up with a great idea, which was this rotational deployments, where troops went in, helped exercise with other countries, helped develop their capability, and continued to have a presence. But it wasn't based on bases in these countries. It was based on having a rotational presence. Great idea. And lastly, investing in the future, investing in space, investing in unmanned technology, investing in special forces. That's the future.
Yeah.
Using that, we then decided, okay, how do we then reduce the defense budget in order to be able to stress those priorities? And look, the defense budget, like any budget, there are areas where you can find savings. That's the nature of the budget. And there were about four key areas you have to look at. One is obviously force structure reductions. So that was one of the areas we looked at. Number two is the area of really trying to go after inefficiencies, the duplication that you see in a big bureaucracy like that, to be able to reduce that. And Bob Gates had done some of that, and we basically built on his efforts. The third is the whole area of new technologies procurement. And procurement costs on a lot of weapon systems can sometimes multiply 100-fold. And what you need to do is to tighten that up and be able to make sure that when you ask for a particular weapon system, it doesn't go off into right field and suddenly you're dealing with something you don't even want. So procurement reforms were part of what we recommended. And then lastly, obviously, even in the compensation and healthcare area, an area that had grown dramatically, we've also had to find ways to have cost controls in those areas. So we recommended a lot of that as recommendations. And the Congress, to their credit, accepted some of those, rejected others. There is a way to do this that doesn't gut the Defense Department. Now, the way you really hurt readiness is when you do these kind of crazy across-the-board cuts that are not based on going after the areas I talked about, but are just based on slashing the defense budget.
So this is the sequester. Yeah.
Sequester was this crazy tool that people came up with. I mean, it's like that scene from Blazing Saddles, where the sheriff puts a gun to his head and says, "If you don't do what I want, I'm going to blow my head off." So the Congress basically made the decision, if we can get a budget deal, great. If we don't get a budget deal, then we're going to develop this crazy across-the-board cut of almost $1 trillion that was going to slash everything, domestic programs and defense. And it's so bad and so horrific that it'll force us to cut a deal. Well, they didn't cut a deal. So sequester is going to go into effect. And I remember going to Secretary of Defense. I couldn't believe, after having to deal with $487 billion in reductions, that they were going to add another $500 billion in cuts. And I remember I went to the President, and I went to the leadership in the Congress, both on the House side and on the Senate side, Democrat and Republican. And I said, look, this can't happen. This is going to hurt our readiness. We won't be able to do maintenance. We won't be able to train. We're going to basically hollow out the military if this happens. And everybody agreed. Everybody agreed. This is bad for America. So I said, okay, bad for America. Maybe we ought to do something about this. And I said, look, let's sit down and try to work out a deal to stop sequester from happening. If you need another $100 million in defense savings, I'm willing to do that as part of a deal so that we can develop something more rational. Nothing happened, ladies and gentlemen. Nothing happened. Which is, I think, an indication of the dysfunction in Washington. If you want to know what the greatest national security threat is in this country, it's the dysfunction in Washington. And so nobody called a meeting, nobody sat down in a room, nobody tried to cut a deal to say this should not happen. They all sat back and sequester happen. And now what you're seeing is they'll try to de-trigger sequester for a couple years, do this, but sequester, the shadow of sequester is still there. And it did go into effect, and it did hurt the military as a result of that. And so I worry about the budget for defense, and for that matter, for the domestic side as well. The worst thing you can deal with at the Defense Department is an uncertain budget. Yep. And I think one of the great failings in Washington is the inability to sit down, President and the Congress, Republicans and Democrats, and come up with a budget deal that addresses this huge debt, the deficit we've got to confront, and does it in a responsible way. I've been there. You know, when I was chairman of the Budget Committee, we began with President Reagan. He put us in a room and said, you got to come up with a deal to try to reduce the deficit. And then we did the same thing with President Bush, and actually President Clinton put together a budget that helped reduce the deficit. But to do it, you got to put everything on the table. You got to put everything on the table if you're going to really deal with that. You've got to put discretionary spending on the table. You've got to put defense. You've got to put entitlements, and you got to put taxes. All of that has to be addressed as part of a package. That's the way you get it. And that's what we did in the Reagan administration. It's what we did with Bush. It's what we did when Bill Clinton's budget went through. And it's a fair way to do it, but it's also an effective way to do it. And as a result of those agreements, ladies and gentlemen, we balanced the federal budget, and we had a surplus. So don't tell me it doesn't work. It can work. But it takes consensus, it takes compromise, and a willingness to cut a deal. And if you don't want to do it, if you just want to play politics, then it isn't going to happen. And we are suffering now from the consequences of those that do not want to sit down and take the risks of making the right decisions on the budget.
Right. Now, right now, we've got people running for president, the majority of whom are making promises that would lead to many trillion dollars in deficits. The range is, I think, from 8 trillion to 18 trillion. Are they going to be able to, whoever wins, is that person going to be able to walk back from those promises, and will Congress support them in that effort?
Well, I think it's craziness. I mean, these people are out there pledging all kinds of things that are going to multiply the federal debt, I mean, to the tune of $14, $15, $16 trillion. I mean, it's craziness. It's craziness. A, it isn't going to happen. And B, what's going to happen is, if somebody's elected who's making these crazy promises, what's going to happen is they won't be able to get anything done. Yeah. And so we'll wind up with another 4 years of paralysis in which nothing is getting done. Look, the reality is that if a president really needs to deal with what is impacting on this country, that president is going to have to first and foremost be willing to govern the country. And to govern the country, you're going to have to be willing to sit down, both Republicans and Democrats, to make decisions on some of these tough issues. And the first issue, frankly, ought to be coming up with a budget deal for the future. Which is not, I know this is not easy. It's tough. But a president owes it to the country to do what's right for the country. Look, George Bush, when we did the budget, with George Bush and he moved his lips, he probably paid a price for the deal that we cut.
This is George Bush.
George Herbert. Bush Sr. Yep. Yeah. And look, Bill Clinton paid a price for the budget we passed in his administration. I mean, Democrats lost the House and the Senate as a result of that. I understand the price that's to be paid, but it is the right thing to do for the country. And the next president, if the next president is willing to have the courage to do that, it may very well be that the next president may be a one-term president, because they'll have to take on their own party to be able to get it done.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing my conversation with Leon Panetta. He's the former Secretary of Defense and former director of the CIA, and he now leads the Panetta Institute with his wife, Sylvia. This event was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience at the Marines Memorial Association. The program was sponsored by former Secretary of State George Shultz. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization, and you can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
So a large problem the next president will inherit is the civil war in Syria and all the and the migrant crisis that results. Was there an opportunity early on, before the foreign fighters moved in, early on in the civil war, was there an opportunity to intervene effectively that we missed?
I think there was. At the time, we obviously knew we were dealing with chaos there. We'd gone through a number of revolutions as a result of the Arab Spring. And now it was impacting in Syria. And you could see it beginning to collapse, and the problem we saw, because these are tribal societies, is that the opposition was very divided in Syria. There were about 100 different groups that were involved in the opposition. We knew that what was necessary here was to try to do what we could to try to help organize the opposition. In Libya, we had faced the same situation with Gaddafi. And what we did there is we made an effort to go into Libya and help support the opposition there. And ultimately, as you know, NATO was willing to go in. And we organized a joint command of all of the countries that were involved there and really helped the opposition ultimately bring down Gaddafi. In Syria, the recommendation by the CIA at the time was that we ought to provide arms to the opposition. And the reason they suggested that was because if we really wanted to have an influence over the opposition, you had to put something on the table. You had to show them that you were willing to really help them. Mm-hmm. And that was the argument. And I thought that was the right argument. And so a number of people at the time, including Secretary Clinton and others, the intelligence people, David Petraeus, myself, thought that we ought to proceed to try to arm the opposition and have some influence to try to make sure that the moderate elements of the opposition took control of the situation. And unfortunately, that did not happen. And I think that was a mistake at the time, not to be able to get involved there. And then I think, obviously, the second mistake that I think was something that was unfortunate was that the president drew a red line about the use of chemical weapons. And you could argue, should presidents draw red lines, and was this the right place to draw a red line? I thought he made the right decision because we were very worried about the use of chemical weapons at the time. And the president said, this was a line they should not cross. And then when they were caught using chemical weapons, killing thousands of people, men, women, and children, at that point, it was important then to show that we were going to stand by our word. And I think when the president decided not to and go to the Congress, that it sent a terrible message to Assad, sent a terrible message to others in the region. Mm-hmm. That we are not going to stand by our word. And that is not a good thing to do when you're president of the United States.
As we look at ISIS, as compared to Al-Qaeda, do we have a sense of the appeal of ISIS? It's been able to recruit at a whole different level from Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
What did you learn from the intelligence agencies and in your role of Secretary of Defense and even in your ongoing role as a private citizen? Have we cracked that nut? Do we understand the allure?
Well, we've obviously We've dealt with terrorism in a number of forms. We've dealt with terrorism in the form of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. Obviously, that had an appeal that recruited a number of people to that cause. What's happened is that we saw a metastasis take place in which other forms of terrorism developed in Yemen, Syria and Iraq, in the form of ISIS, in the form of Boko Haram, in the form of Al-Shabaab. ISIS is particularly horrific because of several things. Number one, they are a terrorist group that obviously is willing to attack innocent people and to conduct attacks, and they are very effective at recruiting. And the way they recruit is through social media, and they're very good at doing that. Secondly, they are a quasi-state because they hold territory. And the whole thrust of terrorism in that part of the world has been to establish an Islamic caliphate. And they've been successful at getting territory in Iraq and obviously in Syria. And they use that territory as a way to attract people to their cause. And then lastly, they are also a revolutionary movement that appeals to individuals and affiliates in other countries. They've been able to establish affiliates in over 20 countries by virtue of the appeal that they have. And so ISIS is dangerous, and they are clear and present danger. The ability to deal with ISIS, I think, is a challenge that involves a comprehensive effort to go after them. The president has identified the right mission, which is to defeat them. Yeah. Whether or not we can put together the kind of comprehensive effort to really get it done is going to be the question that I think remains, particularly for the next president.
To the extent that they measure their own, ISIS measures its own success in terms of capturing and holding territory, is that a traditional military challenge? We know how to fight wars that are over capturing and holding territory. Or is this very different? And in other words, is ISIS defeatable militarily, or is it much more of a metastasizing movement and so something very different is needed?
Well, you know, I think that we've learned a lot of lessons. You know, we've been involved for 15 years now since 9/11, come this 9/11. And the war on terrorism. We've learned a lot. We've learned a lot about counterterrorism. We've learned a lot about the use of special forces. We've learned a lot about how we can train and advise and help other countries develop their security and their ability to deal with terrorism. So I think we can do this. But it requires that not only do we make sure that we have the support that's necessary to get this done, but we have got to build what I think is an alliance in the Middle East that includes Israel, that includes our Arab friends in the Gulf, that includes NATO. Because right now what you're seeing is everybody is kind of doing their own thing. I mean, you know, if you look at Syria, you've got, some that are fighting Assad. Assad is fighting others. You've got the Turks fighting the Kurds. The Kurds are trying to fight. I mean, there's all kinds of crossfire that's taking place here. The Saudis want to get involved. Russia is blowing the hell out of everybody. It's a very disjointed effort. Yeah. Yeah. And to really try to do this, you've got to develop a coordinated approach to this that involves, yes, the United States. I think the United States has to provide important leadership, but it has to involve others in the region who care about the effort to try to go after ISIS and terrorism. That's the only way, I think, ultimately, we're going to be successful, because, incidentally, you can use that same coalition not only to help defeat them, but to carry that larger message to young people, yes, about why this is not the kind of choice they ought to make in terms of the future. Yeah.
Now, diplomatically, what the president has said is that boots on the ground would really just play to the ISIS narrative of it being the David to our Goliath. And so, first, I want to have a sense of whether you agree with that analysis. But then also, he's put a lot of stock in the diplomatic process. And there was an announcement today in that regard. So I wonder, sense of, is that analysis right in your view, number one? And number two, what are the right people at the table for a negotiated
solution? No, I think that there is no need to put another 150,000 troops into another war in the Middle East. And I think the president's correct on that. Having said that, I think if we are to defeat ISIS, we do need to continue to conduct these airstrikes. I think we do need to increase our special forces presence and our trainers and advisors to try to develop troop boots on the ground from these other Arab countries that can be effective, I think, in regaining the territory that needs to be achieved. I think what is needed here is this larger strategy about how do we conduct this war? How do we go after ISIS and push them out of the areas that they've gained control of in Iraq? How do we go after them in Syria? And to develop that strategy that says, you know, we're going to use airstrikes, we're going to use these forces on the ground, the Iraqis, the Saudis, the Kurds, others, as part of this effort to go after them. I think you need to have that strategy in order to support a diplomatic effort. Mm. Because I think the thing that's missing in the effort that, you know, and I give a lot of credit to John Kerry for trying to find a way to resolve this issue. But you can't resolve this simply relying on the Russians or relying on Assad or relying on Iran. The fact is, the only way you back up diplomacy is by showing that we have a clear strategy aimed at defeating ISIS that we are going to implement with or without the Russians. Yeah. And if you have that, then I think that gives John Kerry a lot more leverage to try to negotiate some kind of solution.
Some of the questions relate to the kind of rhetoric we're hearing on in the various presidential debates, et cetera. And one of the topics that keeps coming back up is the issue of Benghazi, if that's an issue. The death of four Americans, including our ambassador, Chris Stevens. You were in government then. What did happen in Benghazi? Everybody's being too nice with their cars.
Well, you know, it's obviously become such a political issue that no matter what you say, you know, people immediately jump into their trenches and have their own view of what they think happened. Look, the reality is that this was 9/11, and we had sat down and looked at concern and intelligence about the possibility of disruption in a number of capitals in the Middle East. You know, we looked at Tripoli, we looked at other locations in Yemen, Sana'a, elsewhere. We looked at, parts of the Middle East that might be subject to disruption. There was this video that was going to be coming out that we thought might create an even greater problem. So at the time, we tried to make sure that we were prepared to respond if there was a crisis in any one of these cities. We had no intelligence, by the way, on Benghazi or the fact that an attack would take place there. And on 9/11, when it did occur, I was I was on my way to talk to the president, and we have regular meetings with the president, both General Dempsey and I, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and I had regular meetings. And so we went over to meet with the president. Just before we went there, I was told that there was this attack going on in Benghazi. and that you know, there was some concern about they knew that the ambassador was there, and were not quite sure what was happening. So when I went into the Oval Office, sat down with the president, and one of the first things that General Dempsey and I told him was that we had just gotten information about an attack that was taking place in Benghazi, and that we didn't have very good information about exactly what was taking place, but it raised a lot of concerns. And the president said, I want you to do everything you can to try to make sure we help our people there and do whatever we can. I went back to the Defense Department. We left the meeting early, went back to the Defense Department, sat down with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and my other military aides, and the decision was made to immediately send orders out that would deploy our special operations units to go and try to rescue those involved in Benghazi. So we had units located in Spain at our base there. We had a unit, a rescue unit, a hostage rescue unit that was located in the United States that we issued orders to deploy over there. We also had another unit that was located in Europe as well. All of them were ordered to get into place, and they did that. Unfortunately, events transpired so quickly in Benghazi that we weren't able to be able to get there because of time and space and distance. And all of that, you know, was tragic. We eventually got a plane in to be able to move the victims and those that were hurt to the hospitals in Germany. Look, the bottom line is that this was tragic, but everything was done. I mean, look, as Secretary of Defense and everybody in the military, we do not leave people behind, and we will go after them and do everything we can to rescue them. And that's what happened here. Despite all the stories, despite all of the, you know, the questions that have been raised, the reality is that everybody who looked at this issue, whether it was the commission that looked at it, whether it was eight committees in the Congress that looked at it, they all determined that we did everything we could to try to respond to that situation.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you to another area of doing all one can, and that's in the case of San Bernardino. We have now in the news that the court has ordered Apple to help in getting into the iPhone that belonged to Mr. Farouk, one of the killers, get past that encryption and see what we can learn about him. I'm turning to you, and this not just because you were Secretary of Defense and head of CIA, but also because you're a lawyer by training who used to head the Civil Rights Division. And so here we have a situation where the FBI has a warrant. The phone belongs to the County of San Bernardino, and they've said, yes, we agree to a search. The court has ordered Apple to assist, and Apple has said no. Who's right?
Yeah. You know, in our country, and I know that everybody always tries to make it a black and white situation, but the reality is we do not have to choose between protecting our security and protecting our freedoms. We can do both in this country. We're great enough that we have the ability to do both. Since 9/11, we had a number of steps that were passed by the Congress that were implemented, pursuant to our Constitution, pursuant to our system of checks and balances. I mean, everything that I did in my capacity as director of the CIA, I had to report to the intelligence committees on everything. Every operation we did at the CIA, I briefed the intelligence committees on, and they were fully aware of all of our operations and all the steps we took. I was required to do that, and I thought, as someone who was in the Congress, that it was the right thing to do. The courts also oversaw some of the steps that were taken, particularly by NASA, or by NSA, rather,
yeah.
In some of the efforts to go after some of this information. And the executive branch does oversight as well, the president fully aware of it. No steps can be taken without the permission of the president of the United States, particularly in the intelligence area. So there are checks and balances. In this instance, I guess what I would really urge, I mean, it's a little unfortunate that this could not be handled outside the public, and that there wasn't an effort to try to at least find a way to get the information without necessarily impacting on the concerns that Apple has with regards to encryption. But in the end, there has to be a way, when it comes to terrorists, to be able to get information about what terrorists are planning. Mm-hmm. And we do that through a court order. That's what we do in this country. I believe that what is needed here is an effort by both the industry and the government to sit down and find a way to be able to do this that can protect both sides. It seems to me, and I don't quite understand why this hasn't happened, why we didn't just basically say, give us the information. We don't need to know your encryption. We don't need to know all of the ways that you're trying to protect privacy for your customers. But at least give us the information off this phone so that we know, but this is a terrorist. You know, we've got a court to confirm that we ought to get this information. Give us that information. That's what we really are interested in.
Right.
I wish it had been resolved in that fashion.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if this is allowed to go to court and eventually it'll reach the Supreme Court, then they will have to make a decision here. But I hope that there's a way to get the parties together to resolve this in a way that serves not only our concerns about freedom and privacy, but also is a way to meet our concerns about terrorism.
Are we going to have a fully staffed Supreme Court?
Well, look, neither party comes to this kind of issue with clean hands. The reality is that the Democrats, when they were in power, created a lot of barriers to Republican presidents who were nominating justices, and Republicans have now done the same thing with regards to a Democratic president. But I wish both sides would understand that they're elected in order to govern this country, and that the Constitution requires that the president should take the step to fill that vacancy. He has the right under the Constitution to name an individual to the court. The Republicans in the Senate side ought to take that nomination, bring it to a hearing, have a hearing on it, and then ultimately, hopefully, bring it to the floor of the Senate where a vote will be held. And at that point, there are those that will vote for it and those who will vote against it. But for goodness sakes, let's not try to, there's a danger here. You've got dysfunction on the part of the executive branch. You've got dysfunction on part of the Congress. They can't work together to resolve issues. The last damn thing we need is a dysfunctional court.
Yeah. You've devoted a lot of your life when you were in Congress, but since, to protecting the California coastline. You're on various commissions. There's a Pew Commission. There's another commission that looks at the future of our oceans. What do you hope to see going forward in that realm?
Well, you're talking about something that is very close to me. I was born in Monterey, my grandfather fished there, and I was raised with the beauty of that coastline. And I can remember when I was elected to Congress, went back, that there was a Secretary of Interior by the name of Watt, who decided that he was going to put up everything up for sale to the highest bidder. And I said, well, wait a minute. there are some areas that should be protected. And I said, he really can't mean that. And I remember I went to Don Clausen, who was a Republican congressman from up near, in the Mendocino area, Eureka. And I said, Don, let's meet with Watt and, tell him about, some of the beauty that we have in our coastlines and see if there isn't a way to make some exceptions here. So we met with him. And, I said, Mr. Secretary, I understand the energy needs, but at the same time, look, we've got a Yosemite, we have a Yellowstone, we have national treasures that ought to be protected. Their beauty ought to be protected. And he said, what are you talking about? And I pointed to a photograph of the Mendocino coastline. I said, look, that's the kind of beauty that we're talking about protecting. And he went up to the picture and said, this would be a great place for an oil rig. And I said, I told Don after that, I said, I think we got problems here. So what I did, knowing that we were going to go into a fight, then we went ahead and developed legislation that basically put a moratorium in place. And we attached it to an appropriations bill, which basically said no funds shall be used in order to proceed with this. And we were able, ultimately, to pass that legislation. We passed it for 20 years, by the way. But I was always worried that at some point, when we ran into an energy crisis, that we'd lose that moratorium. So what I did was I said, I really want to protect the Monterey coastline. So I developed legislation to make it a national marine sanctuary, which normally is done by executive action, but NOAA just had, for some reason, decided not to move forward with it. So I said, to hell with it, I'm going to do it through legislation. So I drafted a bill, put it in, what I did was I eventually was able to get it attached to a continuing resolution.
Listen carefully. This is a man who can get things done.
A continuing resolution is something, obviously, with regards to funding the federal government, the president's going to sign it. So I put this provision into a CR, and sure enough, the president signed it. We created the National Marine Sanctuary. We have Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary now. I really believe that we have a responsibility to protect our oceans. Our oceans are a great treasure. And they're important to our economy. They're important to our life. They're important to our very spirit. I think it was John Kennedy who said that our oceans are the salt in our veins. And I believe that. I think we have a responsibility to do everything we can in order to protect our coastlines. They're under threat because of pollution, because of climate change and the different currents that are now creating dead zones in the ocean. They're under threat as a result of the fishing that's there. We're losing a lot of the fishing resources that were there. We have to develop sustainable fisheries. There's a whole set of steps we have to take in order to protect our oceans that we have to get the world to participate in. But look, we live on this earth for a short period of time. We have a responsibility to make sure that we are good stewards of what God gave us and that we can pass that on to our children.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program featured Leon Panetta. He's the former Secretary of Defense and the former director of the CIA. He now leads the Panetta Institute. This program was part of the George Shultz Lecture Series. World Affairs Council is a nonprofit organization. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.